going on. There's a war zone here today out in the heartland, but the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declared a war on us right now, and by God it's up to you, 'cause there's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
A Building Bridges special, hosted and produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. May Day for the working class, for the 99%. And we're moving on, and we're going to listen to Stanley Aronowitz, who studies labor and social movements and is director of the Center for the Study of Culture, Technology, and Work at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's written at least 25 different books.
Professor Manny Ness's research focuses on working class protest and revolutionary movements. His numerous books include Immigrant Unions and the New U.S. Labor Market, and many, many others.
Indeed. And these two giants join us in conversation about organizing and strategies to win.
How do you both assess as the fundamental problems that confront working people today from capital, just to set the base for the discussion that will follow?
The problems confronting working people are really catastrophic. What we are seeing both in the United States and Western Europe, and to a large extent Southeast Asia, which has had a booming economy, especially manufacturing economy, is a race to the bottom. Capital initiated and operated an offensive on historical gains of working people, and the amount of protest and resistance to that offensive is very spotty. In Greece, there's a general strike every Monday and Thursday. Of course, that's a metaphor. But in most other parts of the world, wages are going down and benefits are being cut. Even in the old social democratic countries of Western Europe, there is really very little resistance. And in China, as an example of a counter tendency, the number of strikes has increased steadily from about 2005 to today. So it may be that the great proletarian revolution is going to take place in China, while in many parts of Western Europe and the United States, the working class is going to be beaten into the dust. There is resistance here, don't misunderstand me. But that resistance, to a large extent, has been very local and very spotty.
I would say that we both have challenges and opportunities today, and working class people at this moment are organizing within their shops, except those organizations have not been codified in any way, what I would call parallel organizing or parallel unions, which are existing in both established traditional unions and also shops that don't have unions. I don't think unions really represent workers the way they once did. They essentially run interference to prevent workers from going on strike and support management interests. So this is the huge question in the United States and beyond. How do we create a organization that is anti-capitalist, and I agree that capitalism is a failure in this country and beyond, and how can those working class organizations emerge in a way that are rank and file based? I think that's the central question that we face here in this country, because traditional unions no longer essentially have that power to represent workers. I wonder whether they ever did.
Well, imagine that we are in 1934. In 1934, there were general strikes in Minneapolis and San Francisco, and there was a national textile strike. But what was interesting about that year is that it was a time when certain union leadership, I mean the miners and the garment workers and the clothing workers, decided that it was no longer feasible for them to maintain an organization of union militancy, although these were bureaucrats of the old school, within the framework of the AFL. So one option, and I'm not saying this is the best option, I'm saying this is an option that we have to consider, is that there might be some breakaway within the AFL-CIO hierarchy itself of certain unions and union leaders who believe that the time has come for them to form this organization. The second possibility would be the IWW possibility, which is to say we disavow the AFL from the outside. None of their institutions are any good anymore. They are are collaborative. They are surrendering working people's rights and living standards, and something new has to develop. The third is, in a sense, a compromise, and that compromise would be, on the one hand, like the Taxi Workers Alliance and perhaps the domestic workers, which are really new unions, decide that they want to affiliate with the AFL-CIO, but basically maintain a much more independent existence and do not rely primarily on contracts or, for that matter, the law to operate their struggles for workers' rights. Those unions would do not say, we are anti-AFL-CIO right now. They say, we want their cooperation and support, but they don't rely on them and they don't submit to the discipline of the AFL-CIO, for example, giving money to the Democratic Party to re-elect Obama and other candidates of the Democratic Party.
Manny, do you want to respond to that, but also want to throw something else into the pot, in that the two things within the last year that really have given some kind of movement to the movement have been the demonstrations in Madison last year and the beginning of Occupy Wall Street later in that year, none of which could be predicted. So are we in a period right now in which new developments, which are totally unpredictable, can be predicted in a way by the kind of period we're in right now?
Starting with your question, Ken, I would say absolutely. I think we are in a crisis of capitalism that we haven't seen since the 1930s, and one in which capitalism cannot retrieve any kind of stability from. The Keynesian model, as well as the neoliberal classical economic model, are failures, and they've both been tried and failed successively over and over again. Certainly, stimulus is better than an austerity program, but in general, both models have failed to support working people. It just demonstrates the failure of capitalism. And in fact, the model that seems to be the most appropriate and the one that actually generated the 1930s workers' movement is one that's based on direct action, one where workers are essentially motivated by not engaging in contracts with management, which is in fact a means both to defend union organizations but also defending capitalism from any kind of strikes that would disrupt production or disrupt business in one way or another. And direct action also leads to other kinds and forms of activity, such as worker control over factories and so forth. And I do see, in fact, through an industrial workers of the world wobbly model, where you would have workers engaged in efforts to manage their own companies. Self-management, I think that's the ultimate goal of unions, where you have workers themselves engaged in the process of collectively operating the means of production and the services in our economy. And I do think we're at an opportune moment, Ken, because we're seeing a increasing escalation of worker activities with each passing month. Occupy Wall Street and Occupy every other city in this country and place, as well as Madison, has spawned a number of important new initiatives amongst workers as well as some organizations to look beyond traditional models. We need to have examples of them, and some of them can be found with respect to the IWW, for instance, engaged in organizing Tomcat Bakery, who were helping the workers organize themselves there, as well as the Chicago Couriers Union, Jimmy John's campaign, and a host of other unions are engaged in international solidarity. The best example would be the United Electrical Workers, which is engaged in a solidarity campaign with the Frente Auténtico de Trabajadores.
In Mexico.
In Mexico, FAT. So we're seeing possibilities not only for local forms of direct action in enterprises, but also international solidarity for these forms, where people are organized across borders in many instances with respect to FAT, and also UE and a number of other, even AFL-CIO unions like FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee.
But before we get into the kind of what is to be done or what is being done, I still would like a little bit more careful analysis or critique of the factors internally and externally to unions that have caused their membership to wither in both the private and the public sector, and their influence among the working class in decline as well.
The picture is, of course, not pretty. We have now had, and I would date this really from the 1950s, but particularly from the mid-1970s or 1980s, what the union's leadership has decided And I think this is pretty much across the board, and they haven't had a meeting in which they had this decision made formally, but they have decided, is that their best bet is to collaborate with capital. That's the underlying problem. They bought, if not ideologically, at least in practice, they bought into the neoliberal model. They have agreed on endless concessions in order to save jobs. Half the time, those jobs were not saved. The other half the time, they were saved, but under conditions like, for example, in the auto workers situation, where they agreed to a two-tier wage system, which is really contrary to the whole tradition of even the most conservative business unions, some of the business unions anyway. So the first problem is the problem of collaboration. The second problem is that these have become insurance companies. The unions have pension plans of their own sometimes, and they administer pension plans which are jointly administered with management. They have, secondly, their own health care programs. They're not bad programs in many cases, but they certainly are institutional kinds of service operations, so that the members become increasingly customers rather than members. The members look upon their union as an insurance company. They don't expect the union any longer to be a militant voice in their behalf. The third thing is that the unions have become an appendage politically to the Democratic Party. This dates back to 1936, but even in 1936 or 1948, even as late as that, unions were not putting their resources, I mean heavily, not only their members, active volunteers in election campaigns, but money into the Democratic Party. Now, it's probable that in the 2012 election, the Democrat presidential candidate Barack Obama and the congressional campaign of the party will receive something in the neighborhood of $300 million from the unions. That is, instead of doing organizing, instead of sponsoring militant direct action, which might include a strike fund in many cases, that's to doing a certain kind of grassroots organizing. Well, that indicates, number four, that the unions now depend to a large extent on the state rather than on their own power. The difficulty with that is that increasingly the membership becomes, if not passive and hostile, the membership decides, and Manny put his finger on it, they decide to create what might be described as a movement of dual power on the shop floor, which means that they're not relying on the union for their power, but they're creating informal networks and informal organization, which may or may not portend for a new labor movement. It certainly could become the basis of it. The difficulty, I think, with all of this is that the union movement still has 13.5 to 14 million members, most of it now in public employment or in the services, and they have a considerable amount of resources, but those resources are not going to resolving the problems that their membership has. To be fair, they would say, well, if we have a Republican president, if we have a Republican Congress, doesn't that mean that we're going to have even worse situation? Well, the answer is obviously yes. But on the other hand, is this the best place, even if you believe that, to put union resources, to mobilize members to volunteer, to spend money? If we had, for the sake of argument, at the local level, not a national party, but at the local level, a series of labor parties, and I don't mean to say the Working Families Party, which in my opinion is an appendage of the Democratic Party, but local labor parties that said, look, if you're going to continue to temporize and take management's point of view and capital's point of view, we're going to run against you. That electoral activity might have some validity. That would be something that people could do that would put the Democratic Party on the defensive and put the unions in a much more aggressive position. They're not even ready to talk about that.
Okay.
Just to respond to that question, which I think is central, about the structure of unions. In the one hand, we are experiencing a crisis of capital, and that we could learn a lot of lessons from the early 20th century with respect to Europe and other cases. For instance, in Italy, when you had the Piano Rosso, a two-year period where workers went on insurrectionary strikes and took over factories in Fiat and so forth, where you had in Germany during the revolution in 1918, shop stewards, and I think this is a critical issue, shop stewards were essentially ignored by the central union hierarchies in Germany. So what happened is that the shop stewards had a direct relationship with workers, brought them together in a democratic form, and they operated in a way where unions, as we have today, that are disconnected to their own members, and they engaged in strikes and direct action within factories in Germany throughout the country. And that was a critical moment that could have led to something much larger. I have to tell you, Stanley, I don't really have much trust in unions anymore. I think that
tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just telling you. I just don't think. I know. I'm just telling you.
He's agreeing with you.
I'm agreeing with you. I just don't think any. I think that we really need to pay attention to people at the lower levels of the hierarchy because they are the ones that are, in fact, engaged in the struggles. I mean, the example of the public sector unions in New York State are in many ways weaker than they are in Wisconsin. And in many ways, Governor Cuomo is doing exactly the same thing as Governor Walker has done in Wisconsin. The only difference is that the unions are compliant. They're agreeing to concessions, and they're forcing their members to engage in concessionary bargaining and concessionary contracts. And I think that's a disgrace in the states. And it shows you how moribund the Democratic Party and absolutely the Working Families Party that endorsed Cuomo is today. Unions today are really boxed in. They have nowhere to go because they will continuously represent management and they have no relationship to their members. And they think, and I think this is why capital and the state doesn't really listen to them, the unions don't really have any connection to the rank and file members. So why should the state or capital even care what the union leadership says?
The Public Employees Federation, as an example, its members turned down the proposed agreement that was made basically between the state of New York and the Civil Service Employees Association, CSEA. And the membership turned it down. So what did the leadership do? They changed the Constitution to make it difficult for the membership to have real control over contract approval. I mean, that's a very, very graphic example of the degree to which the union democracy is being undermined when the membership really strikes out on its own. The problem that we have, however, in New York State, which is true of many other states around the country, is that the law says that workers do not have a right to strike. And so collective bargaining becomes collective begging. You maneuver for little gains here and there, and you are forced to make concessions in order to save jobs.
But the Taylor Act actually was the historical compromise in New York State in the late 60s. And that Taylor Act essentially said, okay, we won't go on strike most of the time, but what we will do is get at least general increases in our wages. That has not happened, and I think it's now time to say management, in this case, the state of New York and the city of New York and throughout the country, has basically failed in honoring its side of the bargain, and I think we now have the right to strike, because management has abrogated it fundamentally throughout New York State.
But we have the example, Manny, and this is the lesson. When the Transport Workers Union, Local 100, went on strike in December of 2005, the labor movement showed up for one nanosecond to support them and then disappeared. They then were penalized because they were isolated and also because, to a large extent, their leadership, Local 100, played the game of the administration. But it was a moment when workers turned down a proposed agreement, go on strike regardless of the law. But the problem then becomes, if you have a single union, no matter how powerful
right.
it is,
right.
that is not being supported by the rest of the labor movement. And when I use the word support, I mean two things. One, demonstrations. I mean two, sympathy strikes. You know, the general strike perspective would have to follow from one union, a major union especially, that decides to break the law. Unless that happens, and unless and until that happens, public employees will be continually imprisoned by the conditions that you describe.
I think you can extend that past the public sector, though, because when you're talking about CWA, when they went on strike, everybody got up to support them, but really, who did any actions? I don't
That's
necessarily
right.
mean strike actions, but who did any civil disobedience? They could have done that. Well, Stella Doro is a
very
case
good
in point, where really you had very, very clear case, and everybody supported them.
Right.
And nobody really did anything on the big union. So I think in the other dimension, and you brought this up in the public sector, but we have to get to the point where unions really support each other, union members support each other, and you get that kind of culture of solidarity throughout the labor movement.
And you have Suttlebees, which is a
right.
Teamster local, which has been locked out, and there's really no action around Suttlebees, you know, and Suttlebees is a highly, highly visible institution in New York City on a number of different levels, real estate, as well as sales of precious metals and all that. There's no sense of solidarity, and there's no discussion of solidarity. And I have to say this, the conditions under which we had moments in the history of the American labor movement under which there was solidarity was that radicals, and I mean that communist, socialist, they were catalysts and organizers of major actions, direct actions, both of the strike variety and of demonstrations and of civil disobedience and so on. What we don't have today, we have militant rank-and-file people in the auto workers, for example. We have militant rank-and-file people in almost every union, major union in New York State, for example. But what we don't have is a political organization that organizes people. Maybe Occupy Wall Street people will become organizers.
Well,
we don't know that.
Let me, since you mentioned that, let me take us to the next point. Certainly economics and trade have been globalized, so breaking down the proverbial borders and the bonds, if you will, of traditional unions, where can we draw our attention to the kind of organizing and the development of workers collectivizing their needs as such to confront capital? What are those project core issues of the 99% that we have seen models for organizing?
In the first place, the independent unions that exist in Mexico are not part of the National Federation, which is basically a pre-front. That is to say, it is connected to the Revolutionary Party that was revolutionary way back when, but became the establishment party for decades. So these were independent unions outside of the framework of the established unions. And in fact, one of the examples in New York City several years ago is when, more or less without support of the rest of the labor movement, the Taxi Workers Alliance blocked the roadways in and from Kennedy Airport and LaGuardia Airport to meet their demands. That is to say, they took direct action. The problem is there wasn't solidarity, and the Taxi Workers Alliance was not recognized by the rest of the labor movement, even though they became part of the Central Labor Council, as a legitimate union because they don't have contracts.
I think there are a lot of very good examples where labor could take an initiative to advance workers' rights from an institutional perspective. For instance, we had in Canada, in London, Ontario, the closure of a Caterpillar train plant where workers were making $25, $30 equivalent an hour. And it's shut down, and the attempted relocation to Muncie, Indiana. You know, the Canadian auto workers really had very little power in making that shift take place because of NAFTA and so forth, and the ability to take advantage of the lower wages now in right-to-work Indiana. So to a very large extent, there's a huge weakness amongst labor institutions, and that we really need to look at the examples of where you find, for instance, Apple workers working for Fox Con in China going on major strikes without union support, or Suzuki Maruti workers in India going on strikes and taking over the facilities of these major auto companies without necessarily union support, in some cases with union support. But you see these international linkages. What we do need is examples that, like FOT and UE and so forth, where you do have a certain degree of solidarity where people are organizing on both sides of the borders. And there are examples that we can draw in a number of cases, but they're not as extensive as we'd like to see. I think we're only beginning to see the roots of this. And I think one area that we should really look at is students and students' abilities to go on strike and occupy their universities and colleges and to engage in working class power through mobilizing workers to follow suit. And you had many examples of that in Europe and Greece, particularly this last year.
It might be that higher education is one of the improbable new fronts for labor action. And I don't simply mean organizing into unions, but I mean for direct action because
right.
of the attack against students as well as of faculty. And I think that might be, and staff, and I think that might be a new front. And if we see that, it doesn't mean that there won't be other fronts, but it's going to be one of the things that I think is pretty much on the horizon. And insofar as we can make any predictions, the debt crisis for students, the cut in programs, the inability of students to get into community colleges because they have cut back on funds for community colleges, that's going to have a tremendous impact in the community, especially because working class kids, that they saw as their only hope because there's no manufacturing jobs and the service sector pays no money at all. So that they think that college is one of their answers. Whether that's true or not, the restriction on college admissions and the cutbacks are going to, I think, evoke more than simply students and faculty. They're going to be community people, parents and neighborhood people who are going to say, you can't do this to our kids.
And the immigrant workforces,
the immigrant
which seem to be doing organizing all over the country.
That's right. Absolutely true.
That's true.
We've hardly begun to skim the surface here.
Well, that's right.
But I think that the lesson of the entire discussion today has been solidarity, which is certainly a good lesson for May Day.
The lesson is really a kind of building bridges and utilizing as part of that solidarity, moving in and out of recreating the relationships between workers where they live and within the community structure that bring people together and create that solidarity and, yeah, new forms of organization.
And we're finding many important examples taking place today, and I think we can improve on them here in New York City.
Oh, there's a lot to improve on in New York City.
Manny Ness and Stanley Aronowitz, thank you for your insights and, most importantly, both the theoretical and organizing work that you continue to do as we plow ahead to revive the organization of the 99%.
Arise, you workers, from your slumber, all you wage slaves, everyone.
The revolution comes like thunder, and the age of hypocrisy is done.
Turn off their televised delusion. Stand up and look them in the eyes.
Declare your mental liberation. Shake off the dust and claim the prize.
So comrades, come rally. In the last fight, let us face the Internationale.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash, and our website is www.buildingbridgesradio.org.